From New Mexico to Illinois, Kansas to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the United States is conducting more COVID-19 tests than any country in the world. But Phil Kirpin of American Commitment says the testing is doing little to slow the spread of the disease. He is here to explain. The confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court are over. Now the U.S. Senate is set to move on confirmation. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on what happens next. It is an American tradition, the election night victory party. But this year's results in the presidential election are likely to be delayed by days or even weeks. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine examines why. And the left says it is for diversity. But when it comes to diversity of thought, they demand conformity. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Widespread testing for COVID-19 was supposed to slow the spread. It isn't working. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He joins us now to explain why tests that provide instant results are needed before testing can have any practical impact. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, one of the strategies that was supposed to work in terms of containing the spread of COVID-19 is to ramp up testing. Have we succeeded in ramping up testing for COVID-19?
Well, we're running by far the most tests of any country in the world, over 1 million tests per day in the last couple of weeks. Whether that has been a success is a different question. I would say it has not been. But if you're just counting tests, then we are number one now.
You say that whether or not it's been a success, you don't think it has been. And as I mentioned, one of the strategies that was supposed to allow us to contain the spread of the virus was testing. Why do you say it hasn't been successful?
Well, Loman, I think we're using the wrong test, is the short version. And I'll unpack that a little bit for you. The tests we've been using are called reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction tests, PCR tests, they're usually referred to as. And these are lab tests that are extremely, extremely sensitive, and they can find any tiny trace amount of virus by using doubling cycles. And so they take the original amount of virus, and then they double it and double it and double it and double it, sometimes up to 40 times. And then they, if there's any virus at all present, they'll call that a positive. The problem with this type of test is, well, there are two problems. One is that it can't differentiate between a current active infection and old dead viral debris from an infection that's months old, or even from contamination in the room or on the swab in some circumstances, because even the tiniest trace amount can cause a positive. And the New York Times did an article in late August. They were actually able to obtain data from three states, and they found that about 90% of the test results that were positive were old dead virus. They were not currently infectious. And so the vast majority of the people who are being told to isolate are doing so unnecessarily. They're not infectious. They couldn't infect anyone. They may have had the virus, but it was probably months ago. So that's number one. Number two is the turnaround time. The idea of taking a sample, sending it off to a lab, waiting for the lab to process it, and then notify you of the results means that in the best case scenario, you're talking about a day or two, and in the worst case scenario, it can sometimes be up to a week. The infectious period typically for coronavirus is 5 to 7 days after symptom onset, sometimes up to 10 days. That's why the recommendation for when you can go back to work and come out of isolation is 10 days after symptom onset, because that covers the entire expected infectious period. Well, if you're only infectious for 5 to 7 days and figure you don't take the test the first day, you feel a little off, you have symptoms for a couple of days, then you go take a test. If it takes them a few more days to get the result back to you, then by the time you have the result, you're not infectious anymore, and it can't actually be helpful in terms of modifying your behavior any more than if you had just isolated based on the symptoms. And so we're running 1 million tests a day, but they don't have much of a positive impact on limiting the spread of the virus, because a huge percentage of the people who are told they're positive are not actually currently infectious. It's based on old infections, and for people who are currently infectious, they don't really get the result in time to meaningfully alter their behavior. And so the test that we really need is one that is less sensitive, that doesn't answer the question of, is there any virus anywhere in your body, including old dead viral debris, but rather answers the question of, am I infectious right now? And we need it to be instant. We need the results to come right away, not to take a couple of days of turnaround time.
If we have these tests turning up old dead viral material and thereby inflating the number of positives, and of course, everybody fixates on the number of positive tests, and that therefore drives public policy, having this type of testing that is showing up positives for people who may never have even shown symptoms months ago, is that not creating a situation where policymakers are acting on flawed data?
It's definitely creating that situation, and it's created a lot of unnecessary panic. And frankly, we paved the way on that. Now Europe is copying us. They're now doing mass population scale testing using overly sensitive tests and getting these huge numbers of positives and freaking out about it. And so instead of us learning from them and learning the right lesson, they're copying us and going down the path of generating these large, highly deceptive numbers, which then scare the public and push policymakers towards, you know, lockdowns and other restrictive policies.
So having a test that you can take in the morning and in 5 minutes or 15 minutes know whether or not you are positive, and then you know whether or not to go about your day, and having that test to be fairly inexpensive so people can actually afford to use it, it seems like a no-brainer. Why is that not being done, and who is holding up the process?
The FDA is. The FDA bureaucrats, there have actually been applications for instant home tests filed with FDA as far back as March. The technology was developed at MIT using a specially coated strip of paper. Abbott Labs it was the first company to have a version granted authorization. So there is one of these handheld little instant tests, low cost, that is authorized. Their version is $5, not $1 or $2. They put it on a fancy-looking plastic credit card and linked it to an app, and now they're charging $5 instead of the $1 or $2 price point that had been talked about. But even at $5, that's pretty good, because if you could pick up a 10-pack for $50 and have them at home to use anytime you need to verify that you're negative that day, that would be helpful for an awful lot of people. The problem, from my standpoint, is they've only authorized the Abbott test to be administered by a licensed lab technician. They have not authorized it for home use. And if you need to get an authorized lab technician to administer it, the $5 for the test is going to have plus $50 for the person who's administering it, and it's going to be much less accessible. And, you know, you need to go to a place where you've got a licensed lab tech, and it therefore becomes much, much less useful. And so we've got a good step in the right direction that the Abbott version of this has been authorized. But what we really need is an authorization of testing for home use, and they need to authorize a few of these other manufacturers to get that price point down even lower, too.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin. Phil, of course, is president of American Commitment. He joins us from time to time here on American Radio Journal. And Phil, tell us a little bit about American Commitment, and where can folks go on the web to learn more?
We are a national free market advocacy group. We work on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues from the perspective of limited government. And we try to find fights that are on the margin, where a little bit of citizen engagement and effort writing to regulatory agencies or Congress or the White House can make a difference and tip these fights in a more free market direction. And of course, there hasn't been much going on much of the normal things we work on for this most of this year because of COVID. So we've been focused on, you know, trying to get things reopened and get the threat of this under control so that people are comfortable kind of reengaging economically. AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you again for being here.
Thanks, Loman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He does keep an eye on political developments around the country and also action on Capitol Hill. Today we're going to focus on Capitol Hill and the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
So this past week, Scott, we had the hearings and you watched a large portion of it. Give us your take as to how well you think that went in terms of moving the justices' confirmation forward on the time schedule that Senate Republicans have laid out.
I think that both Democrats and Republicans on the committee got a chance to hear directly from Judge Amy Coney Barrett on a number of issues, the way that she thinks about what the court's position should be and her jurisprudence and the record that she has. There was a lot to learn from from Judge Barrett. And I think that having her family sitting right behind her certainly helped bring sort of a personal feeling in that hearing room. And I think that a lot of the Democrats pointed it out that she had a beautiful family and seemed like somebody that was doing a great job leading her family and working with her husband to have a beautiful family, that kind of thing. But when it got to a lot of the questions, there obviously are accusations thrown around from the Democrats. There were really political grandstanding. I would say that they were treating it more like a campaign event because they understand that the confirmation of Judge Amy Coney Barrett is a fait accompli and she will be confirmed. So what they're doing instead is they're highlighting issues with pre-existing conditions and health care. They're talking about whether or not there's going to be a Supreme Court consideration of the election outcome. They're doing all these things to get the voters' attention. And instead of considering Judge Barrett for her high qualifications to the land's highest court, they're making this more about the 2020 November election, which really shouldn't surprise us, right? I think that partisanship on the Hill is about as high as it could be leading into a really competitive election. But during a pandemic, there's been a stalemate here, and the stimulus legislation that the Republicans and Democrats are considering, that will set us up for something to happen after the election or maybe even at the beginning of next year, depending on the election outcome. So we've got the lame duck coming, but thinking about Judge Barrett and the schedule ahead here before the election, we think she's on a clear path to confirmation.
Let's talk a bit more, Scott, about the process going forward. The hearings having concluded, now the Senate Judiciary Committee has to take action. That does give Democrats a bit of an opportunity for chicanery, does it not?
It does. The Democrats need to be present in order to provide for a quorum. A quorum means that there's the sufficient number of members in attendance to do official business of the committee. And in the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, the committee rules say that there needs to be at least 7 members from the majority and 2 members from the minority to constitute a quorum. The Democrats are threatening to withhold their participation, and so Republicans are thinking about ways that the rules would be changed or other ways that the majority leader and the Senate majority at all could come together to still bring Judge Barrett to the floor in a timely fashion and make sure that she's confirmed before Election Day. I think the biggest thing here is making sure that the Republican senators are healthy. We've obviously seen Senator Lee at the Judiciary Committee this week. He is recovered from COVID and doing a great job in his role as a committee member, talking about Judge Barrett and her qualifications and introducing her to the American people. And we just got to make sure that they continue to have the votes.
Since the approval of the committee is not really required, and since we already know exactly what the vote would be if everybody, in fact, did show up, is it possible for the Senate to just move on final confirmation, even if the Judiciary Committee is unable to get a quorum or make a recommendation?
Yeah, I think that what you'll see Leader McConnell do is really consider the way to discharge the nomination from the committee if it got to that point. And once he discharged it to the Senate floor, there would be various motions offered by both the majority and the minority in the Senate. And they'd have a couple of votes before they got to what I think would be a final passage situation. So Democrats can try to slow it down, but I think a lot of them do understand that the confirmation is going to happen, and they're instead focusing on the 2020 election and messaging on these big issues like health care to the American people when they've got a large bully pulpit with the national coverage of the hearing.
And when would we expect that vote on final confirmation to occur?
Yeah, right now I think if you just kind of think through the timeline and the way that the committee action and official action on the Senate floor comes together, it can be a pretty complex way to really burn time. But there's Senate rules in place, and I think that if the rules are largely proceeded upon without any major hiccups, then we should be expecting final passage either on October 26th or 27th. If it takes a couple of extra days that week, that's fine. There could be ways that Democrats slow it down, but really the week of the 26th, I think, is what we should be expecting.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as we always do, let's end with having you tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @ClubForGrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you again next week. Thank you.
Thanks.
It took until early December for the 2000 presidential election to be decided. It likely will be days or even weeks before we know the results of this year's balloting. Eric Baim of Reason Magazine reports.
It feels like ancient history now, but Americans had to wait more than a month after Election Day to learn that George W. Bush had beaten Al Gore back in the year 2000. Declaring a winner in that race involved recounting about 62,000 votes in Florida and eventually a ruling from the Supreme Court. Now, if this year's election stretches out longer than it probably should, it most likely won't be due to butterfly ballots or hanging chads. At least we can hope. The election controversy that is most likely to happen this year will probably revolve around, and indeed it already is revolving around, the expanded use of absentee ballots and mail-in voting as an alternative to having millions of people line up at polling places in the middle of a pandemic. The trade-off that comes with those safer voting options is that absentee ballots typically take days or sometimes even weeks to be counted. And some states are already implementing rules that effectively guarantee there won't be a winner declared on Tuesday, November 3rd. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Baim with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me today. Instead, we're taking an up-close look at a topic that's going to be front and center for the next few weeks, I'm sure. That is the fact that the presidential election, as it winds down, and other big elections around the country as well, the Senate and some key state races may not be decided on November 3rd. In fact, it may take days or even weeks to decide who has won them. Now, patience is not typically a virtue in American politics, and certainly of late it has not been a virtue, but this year it may have to be. It's impossible to know right now exactly how long it may take to count all the votes in all the states, but we can get some sense of what to expect from what some big states went through during primary season. In places like Georgia and New York, for example, that relied heavily on mail-in voting for their primary elections back in the spring and summer, there were long delays in reporting results. In fact, it took New York more than a month to finish counting all of its absentee ballots, and of course, larger volumes of ballots and votes are expected in November. While a few states have moved to full-scale vote-by-mail operations in recent years, and have done so, it should be noted, without any uptick in voter fraud or a significant disadvantage to either major party, that is a process that takes time and money to do correctly. So this year, lacking time, most states have just simply bootstrapped expanded vote-by-mail operations onto their existing absentee ballot systems. And for the most part, those states are just crossing their fingers and hoping for the best. In-person voting is generally preferable because it limits mistakes that can happen, and obviously it speeds up the counting process as well. Counting absentee ballots takes a lot of time. You have to review each of them one by one, and even though computers help with that, much of the work is still done by hand. And that delay is going to be especially a problem in states that don't have a true vote-by-mail infrastructure in place. In short, even though voter fraud is not really a concern for mail-in balloting, there's literally a paper trail for every vote cast, there are good arguments in favor of in-person voting. It's faster and less vulnerable to mistakes, and the goal of expanding vote-by-mail should not be to abolish voting booths or the option of in-person voting. It should only be to provide an alternative for those who want it. Another problem that has emerged somewhat unexpectedly is that both major parties are now playing partisan games with the vote-by-mail system. Not necessarily things that are illegal, but things that certainly count as electoral gamesmanship. In Pennsylvania, for example, the state Supreme Court there, which has a majority of judges elected as Democrats, has decided that counties must accept any ballot that gets delivered within 3 days of the election. That means ballots that arrive on the Wednesday or Thursday or Friday after Election Day will still be counted as long as there's an indication that they were mailed or attempted to be mailed before Election Day. But that, of course, could increase the number of accepted ballots in Pennsylvania, a key swing state. And since more Democrats have requested absentee ballots nationwide than Republicans have, increasing the potential number of mail-in ballots that are accepted potentially increases the number of Democratic votes, or presumably would increase the number of Democratic votes that are eventually counted. On the flip side of things, you have Republican officials in states like Ohio and Texas that are limiting the number of absentee ballot drop-off boxes to only one per county instead of as many as 10 or 12 per county as some counties in Texas originally planned. And again, that is just a bit of partisan gamesmanship that's attempting to limit the number of ballots that are successfully returned and successfully counted out of a pool of ballots that is presumed to be quite blue, quite Democratic-leaning. Another thing that feels a bit like ancient history now was this year's Iowa caucuses, where the use of vote recording software led to confusion and delayed caucus reporting. Just a few weeks after that, political scientist Richard Hassan hosted a hastily organized conference with the goal of making suggestions for how states could better secure the legitimacy of the 2020 general election, despite the coming challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. In April, the group that he headed up released a report with 14 recommendations, ranging from expanding mail-in and early voting options to just basically informing the public, what I'm doing right now, actually, about the potential delays in reporting results. Hassan told Reason that he says that voters, candidates, and observers should all anticipate a long lag time between the end of voting and getting official results. And if it's very close, he warns, Florida 2000 could look like a picnic compared to what we have to deal with this year. The bottom line is that it's incumbent for voters to be informed about the process and willing to accept that slow election results are more likely to be the result of the unprecedented circumstances surrounding the 2020 election and not the result of deliberate malfeasance. Yes, obviously we should be vigilant for voter fraud, and any attempts to swing the outcome of the election via fraudulent means should be uncovered and prosecuted to the fullest extent. But in these unusual circumstances, the first thing we could all do is take a deep breath, relax, and trust that at some point in the days or weeks after the election, we will know definitively who the winners are. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the campaign and of all of the circumstances surrounding this bizarre election season at Reason.com. And I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The left talks incessantly about diversity, but on this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains that when it comes to diversity of thought, particularly on the nation's college campuses, conformity, not diversity, is required. Paul?
I'm experiencing from supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement something I've gone through with the LGBTQ movement, namely a refusal by many advocates to permit any disagreement, even when the person, someone like me, offers support for other elements of their agenda, arguably the most important elements, like no discrimination. Sure, this doesn't include everyone in the movements, but it includes too many, especially in the cancel culture. I recently saw it again in a letter against me by about a dozen signers, mostly faculty, at a college in California, a college that I'll leave unnamed. They want the college to pull its sponsorship, i.e. funding, of a talk that I'm scheduled to give on socialism and democratic socialism. What that letter claimed in merely one sentence, that's all, about my beliefs, is flatly inaccurate, strikingly absurd, with no quotes or citations. The details, though, are less important to my point here and the phenomenon that I'm describing in this commentary, and that is the refusal to permit any criticism or dissent. Let me illustrate. I just did a book called The Devil and Karl Marx, which drills down on the genuinely diabolical elements of Marx, Marxism, and communism, and it has not a single reference to Black Lives Matter. And yet, in numerous interviews for the book, literally almost every interviewer asked me about Marxism and BLM's founders. It's the elephant in the living room, especially Patrice Cullors, who said of herself and BLM co-founder Alicia Garza, quote, "We actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia, in particular, are trained organizers. We are trained Marxists," unquote. In another interview, Patrice Cullors added, quote, "I went through a year-long organizing program at the National School for Strategic Organizing. We spent the year reading anything from Marx to Lenin to Mao," unquote. Patrice expands on this in her memoirs, which include a foreword by America's most famous female Marxist, Angela Davis, a mentor and inspiration to her. So, with BLM such a hot topic right now, interviewers naturally ask my thoughts. I always get asked about the About section of BLM's website, which underscores goals utterly unrelated to George Floyd or police reform, seeking, for instance, to rally comrades, yes, they actually use that word more than once, and cisgender people to, quote, "disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure," unquote, something that has absolutely nothing to do with George Floyd. And yet, here's my concern and my point. It seems as if no one is free to object to any such language, even while commending BLM in its condemnation of abuses like George Floyd. It begs the question, must one accept every element of an organization's agenda, its founders and its inspirations, with no room for criticism of items objectionable, if not troubling? Why this 100% or nothing mentality? Total commitment to the entire line, word for word, or else you're a bigot who thinks that black lives don't matter. In my interviews on these questions, I attempt to answer thoughtfully with respect to my interviewers and BLM alike. I try to engage in civil discourse, responding with care, with the intention of shedding light, of educating, of hopefully calming the heated rhetoric. As people have heard in my commentaries before, I've spoken out on the outrageousness of BLM's hashtag abolish the police. I've suggested other language like hashtag reform the police with the intent of helping, making America a better place. Elsewhere in long articles and interviews, I've applauded BLM's crusade against police violence for leading the charge against injustices like George Floyd. And yet, I found that even answering questions from interviewers about, say, Patrice Cullors' statements about Marxist influences causes a nasty backlash and gets you called names. I ask, is there no room for intelligent discourse anymore? Must universities become echo chambers of leftists who purge from podiums anyone who dissents from their ideological orthodoxy? They say they want diversity. No, they don't. They do not want diversity of thought. Conservatives like myself are banned from their platforms. They seem to genuinely fear vigorous give and take. The intolerance fosters the intolerant situation that we now have. No criticism, no dissent, and no fun. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, The Devil and Karl Marx.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WRYV-FM in Milroy, Pennsylvania, WGFP-AM in Webster, Massachusetts, along with KCHW-FM in Chewelah, Washington. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.